Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
We call him Sparky Doodah. He's probably one of the sillier boys, and he definitely needs TLC.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else the Iditarod and the dogs and the people who run the race. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we get too doggy, how about a word from our sponsor?
Support for Iditapod 2020 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media. That was Ali Zirkel, the musher from Two Rivers, running the Iditarod again this year at the very top there. It's Monday. The Iditarod sled dog teams are heading into their second full day of racing after the official start yesterday in Willow. From there, they mushed west to the Yentna checkpoint about 50 miles into the race, on to Squintna at about 80 miles. As of midday here on Monday, all of the teams are into Squintna or out of Squintna. Some of the back of the packers appear to be hanging out there, but the front of the pack teams are already heading up and up and up into the Alaska Range toward the mountainous checkpoint of Rainy Pass. And guess what? Right up there near the front is reigning champion Pete Kaiser. There's always leapfrogging going on in the Iditarod, especially right now as the teams are still somewhat bunched up and have their own particular run-rest schedules. But Pete jumped out in front last night and seems to be looking to run somewhere near the front of the pack for now. Still a lot of racing to go, of course, as this is a 1,000-mile race and we're just barely into it. One musher who is in it too and who jumped in really at the very last minute is John Schandelmeyer from Delta Junction. He surprisingly appeared yesterday at the starting line wearing his wife Zoya Denier's race bib. That's number 42. He was on the runners behind the team. We weren't expecting it. That's because Zoya had to drop out due to an illness. And a brief update on that, in a written statement late last night, the Iditarod said that race marshal Mark Nordman allowed the substitution, quote, in the best interest of the members of the race team who have been training all year for this opportunity. I guess that would be the dogs. The statement goes on to say, I imagine as a way of explaining that decision that Schandelmeyer is a two-time Yukon Quest champion, that he competed in the Iditarod in 1993 and many other races over the years. The statement quotes the Iditarod's rule number 4 that, again, quote, substitute drivers will be allowed only in cases of emergency and only if approved by the race marshal prior to the restart of the race. That decision apparently up to Mark Nordman, the race marshal, and that's about as much as we currently know about that situation. What's interesting is that Schandelmeyer, for all of his dog mushing experience, is considered a rookie in this year's Iditarod, as he actually had a scratch in his one other attempt. Again, that was back in 1993. With the substitution of Schandelmeyer for Denier, there are now 13 rookies in the race. And whether they're very experienced rookies or not, as KNOM's Ben Matheson reports, the race will be a test of their years of training, their dreaming, and hard work.
As Quince Mountain plots his run and rest schedule for his first Iditarod, he's weighing his options for camping between checkpoints and facing an unpredictable trail. He's not sure yet how much camping is even possible this year.
If there's good enough snow and halfway decent weather, I'll probably camp out on the trail quite a bit. But it might just be that there's nowhere like packed down to pull off. I mean, you can't just stop in the middle of the trail and camp and nobody can get by you because they're 6 feet deep in a snowdrift.
He's packing wide runners for a little extra float on the snow. Mountain runs dogs with his wife, Blair Braverman, who completed her first Iditarod last year. In Grayson Bruton's rookie run, he's taking a team of 13 2-year-olds and 1 5-year-old.
He's one of the pinch hitters. Just like, you know, if I get in a pinch out there on the trail, he'll use him as a leader. But other than that, we're going to use all the young dogs this year.
Bruton has run dogs as part of Mitch Seavey's kennel for 4 years. He says he's ready for a physical and slow-moving trail after training the dogs along the Denali Highway in deep snow. With the puppy team, Bruton's job is to get as many of the young dogs as he can to Nome and give the dogs real race experience, including time in lead.
All 14 of them will run up front, and they all take G and Haw commands, and you know, some are better than others, but they all run up front, and they all do a good job up there, and they're all going to get rotated through the front.
While Bruton is running dogs from one of the sport's most established kennels, Mille Porsild spent the preseason building her team from scratch with dogs from Didi Jonro, Jeff King, Dean Osmar, Sim Smith, and Jesse Holmes.
And then the challenge has been to, you know, basically create a team out of these guys that they consider themselves a unit, and a unit with me, of course. So that's a different challenge than what I've run in the past, but it's actually been a really gratifying experience.
Porsild has been around the Iditarod and sled dog racing for several years as she worked with Jor Leifsef Olsen. Originally from Denmark, she got her start in adventure travel on Arctic expeditions with explorer Will Steger and has raced dogs in Chukotka, Russia. For Fairbanks musher Riley Dyke, this year's race is his second 1,000-mile race after he completed the 2018 Yukon Quest. He's raised his team from puppies and says they're ready for the challenge of deep snow.
I'm fine with the slow trail. We live in a really hilly area, and my dogs are used to hard pulling. You know, we do glacier tours and chest deep snow on the dogs all summer at 70 degrees. So they're used to punching around and slogging through deep snow. So I think that, you know, I'm all right with it. It's going to be more work for me, but I guess I'll stay warm that way.
As the rookies face fresh snow and the race's most technical sections this week, they'll be one step closer to becoming Iditarod finishers. For KNOM, I'm Ben Matheson in Anchorage.
That report on the rookies from Ben. One of the rookies we heard from there was friend of the Iditapod, Quince Mountain of Mountain, Wisconsin. Quince is following his wife, Blair Braverman's rookie run from last year with one of his own. Quince and I sat down for an interview here in the warmer, much less snowy Alaska Public Media studio in Anchorage last week. There's an extended bonus version of that I just posted on the Iditapod today. It's about 30 minutes or so. We talked about all kinds of different things, what Quince wants to get out of the Iditarod, how he was on the reality TV show Naked and Afraid last year, how the group of fans that follow him and Blair came to be called the Ugly Dogs. We also talked about how Quince is the first person to be openly transgender running the Iditarod. We talked about that, how in an event that has always seen men and women competing side by side and not separated into categories, it doesn't mean that much to the race or the competition, I guess, itself. But as Quince says, it means a lot to some people in terms of inspiration. And while we talked about a lot more in the whole interview, I want to now share a section of it about that part of Quince's life.
It's neat for me as a trans person because I don't have to worry about, you know, what category I might be placed in order to take part in the sport. It's just not a thing. I don't even think until recently I was on Discovery show Naked and Afraid. I think before that, I don't think a lot of people even necessarily knew I was trans in the mushing community. Maybe they did. It's always something I've been open about. I'm a writer. I've always been sort of publicly trans. Sometimes I wish I weren't, but I always have been. And so, you know, it's just nice. I don't have to deal with all the questions about which category I belong in, and that's really nice. And also beyond which category would I enter? There's also like the dogs. Like the dogs are my teammates and they don't care. They just don't care. You know, it's not like we're in a locker room and there's some weird dynamic. I mean, we're just all mushing down the trail.
Yeah, that is one really cool thing about the Iditarod. Like you say, I mean, it's not like a running race or something and you've got to pick which category. It's like the men and the women and whoever wants to enter can all race against each other. It's just a really unique thing about dog mushing.
Well, and if you look at the dog bloodlines, that relates to, right? Like, just as the gender of the musher doesn't really matter. I mean, this is an event that's focused on the dogs, and the gender of the dogs also doesn't really matter. The bloodlines of the dogs, they're not bred for some look standard. It doesn't matter what color they are unless you're Jim Lanier and you just prefer to run white dogs because it looks cool. It doesn't matter if they're male or female. It doesn't matter what their background is. They're bred for performance. They need to eat well on the trail over the course of a 1,000-mile race. They need to have tough, a good positive mental attitude, be very forward oriented and driven, have tough feet, have good coats, a nice Arctic coat that can withstand the conditions and can thrive in the conditions they face out on the trail. So that's what the dogs are bred for, not, who's going to be in the Westminster show next week.
Right. So, I mean, having said like gender isn't really that important to the race itself, maybe this is a weird question, but do you see yourself in this race as a openly trans person as being historic in any way? Or do you think about that at all?
It's so weird, Casey. Like, I used to not think about it. And then at some point, you know, as people began asking me about it or commenting on it, I mean, I do sort of think about it. So I go back and forth. Sometimes I think, well, it doesn't really mean anything. It's not really relevant to my race. And I don't want to assume that I'm the first trans person, but as you say, you know, the first, maybe the first openly trans person, I think there's something important there in that, I'm not that different. I'm not, you know, history right now, where we're at right now, is allowing me to be the first openly trans person. If I had mushed an Iditarod in 1982, I wouldn't be. I would have kept my gender inclinations to myself, probably, because I wouldn't have been allowed to get there, most likely. So I have to respect that and understand the people who likely came before me. And also, you know, then I get messages about the people coming after me, coming behind me. And it's so exciting. I mean, I was, you know, I really wasn't able to take part in sports as a kid growing up, in team sports. I know some trans people were, but I wasn't. I had a hard time. It wasn't my experience. I wasn't really allowed on the teams. And so I found ways to do my own thing, ride horses, now dogs. But I never competed with horses in any way. Now with the dogs, I get to be out there challenging myself on this course. But I do think it does matter to a lot of people, because I get messages from young people, and I get messages from parents. And just today, I met somebody, I hung out with somebody a little bit who's also a trans man, and, you know, also had an evangelical background that wasn't accepting of it when he was a kid. And so, you know, I think being able to just be out doing my thing, you know, using my platform, I guess, if that, when parents say to me, which, I mean, I keep saying this, but it happens a lot. I get a lot of notes that are like, my kid came out to me as trans, and, you know, I've been accepting of them, but it was hard to imagine their future. And now seeing you helps me imagine that they can live their dreams, you know, and that gives me chill. I mean, that makes me excited about what all those people are doing. And it probably won't be mushing the Iditarod, but that doesn't matter, you know, whatever it is, the fact that we don't have to be limited in the ways that we have been is pretty fantastic.
Really, really, really appreciate Quince coming in and talking about all of that. We've really been lucky to have him on the podcast. I hope that we hear from him again out on the trail. Quince and Blair really have a great fan following. We appreciate having them along for the ride too. Another fan favorite is perennial top 10, sometimes top 2 finisher, Allie Zirkel from Two Rivers. She is always surrounded by people at the ceremonial start in Anchorage, and while I always feel lucky to get a chance to talk to Allie, I felt especially lucky this year to have a few minutes to talk to her there at the ceremonial start. One thing that we talked about, and this is our dog profile of the day, was her dog, Sparky.
His name is Sparky, but we call him Sparky Doodah.
Sparky is 6.5 years old. His parents are Nacho and Olivia. He's part of a litter named for things related to fire. I'll let Allie describe how he looks.
He's, I would say, brown, but his standout kind of markings is his face, because he's got the streak down the face with a big kind of splotchy nose.
Awesome.
He's got ears that stand up, but they're flip over at the top.
And here's how Allie describes Sparky's personality.
He definitely needs TLC. There's just like people, there's the hardcore kind of guy, football player, who's like, oh, just leave me alone, I'll do it. And we've got a couple of them, but I would have to say Sparky's not. Sparky needs like, hey, Sparky, how are you doing? Good boy, do you need a little massage? Is it okay? And then he works perfectly. But I would have to tell you, he is one of our best leaders. But see how he gets all in there? He's like, no, it's me. It's all about me.
Mm-hmm.
So
he needs that attention.
He does. He needs the attention. So I know that, and I give it to him. Some of the other guys aren't that way, but he certainly is.
That was Allie Zirkel talking about her dog, Sparky. And if you want to see photos of the dogs and these profiles and all the rest of our Iditarod content, check out alaskapublic.org. There are many other photos of all things Iditarod. Those dog profiles, that's kind of a new feature for us, not exactly a new idea. But another feature here on the Iditarod that we've had for years are our listener questions. And it's time now for today's listener question.
Hi, this is Lisa from Cincinnati, Ohio. I was wondering if there are different types of sled runners for differing snow conditions. And I was also wondering whether the mushers will drop different sled runners at certain checkpoints depending on what they might anticipate on the trail ahead.
Hi, Lisa. This is Zach. Great question. Definitely. Mushers have sled plastic that does better or worse in different kinds of snow and in different temperatures. So if you're mushing in 40 below, there's a harder plastic that mushers tend to use. Likewise, if it's 30 or above and kind of wetter conditions, there's another plastic that mushers will use. A lot of the material is specially built so that it slides in and out of runners. And definitely mushers will send different runner plastics out in their drop bags so that they have options when they're at different checkpoints and can swap things in and out. In the last couple of years, we've also seen mushers like Jeff King experiment with wider runner plastics. So I don't know how much the composition of the plastic itself is different, but definitely it's wider and covers a larger surface area. So if you think of it like skis, thinner skis for a kind of classic skiing track versus wider skis for backcountry skiing or heavy powder days, it's kind of the same. They want more surface area to float above it. That's not as widely used as some of the different composites on plastic runners, but definitely it's something that mushers are considering, and at a lot of the checkpoints you'll see them fiddling with knives to get the plastic on and off to equip their sleds better. So thank you. Great question.
Thanks for the great question, Lisa, and thanks for the answer. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes coming through with the answer. Quick update on Zach. He, like a lot of people trying to fly out to reach checkpoints along the Iditarod Trail, was grounded last night and for a good chunk of today due to weather. I got a text from him not too long ago that he and Pilot Rob were going to try to squeak through a weather window because, while it's apparently clear around a lot of other places, it wasn't around the Birchwood Airport where they were. So we're still waiting to hear if they made it out, but if he does, the plan is to make a stop at Rainy Pass, then head on to the Rhone and Nikolai checkpoints, all in one day, apparently. The intrepid reporter, Zach Hughes, and the mysterious pilot we know simply as Pilot Rob. Good luck, fellas. So, Zach with the answer to that question about the plastic that mushers use on their sled runners. We are starting to get all sorts of questions from our listeners, much appreciated. To send us a question, the best way to do that is to record yourself on a voice memo. Tell us who and where you are, and send that audio to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. You might get yourself on the podcast. Okay, that's all the time we have for today. I'm tired. Not as tired as Zach and the mushers are going to get, but between posting the last podcast last night, getting up to do our radio station's morning Iditarod report this morning, and putting together this podcast, I got like 4 hours of sleep, so I'm going to go take a nap. We'll be back tomorrow as our daily episodes continue. Our theme music, it's by the band Sassafras. I'm the man on the mic, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
That's my stomach.
Somebody didn't have enough hot dogs.
I didn't have any. No, that's my stomach digesting a day-old pizza that has jalapenos on it.
That was you?
Yeah,
that was impressively
me.
Loud.
I thought that was you because you looked at your stomach.
I couldn't tell if it was me or not.
No, I mean, I can do louder. Well, not by choice, but I have a very vocal stomach.
I call them internal farts.